Nuclear food contamination. Just because you can't see radiation, taste it, touch it, feel it, or hear it, doesn't mean that the radiation released by nuclear reactors, weapons, manufacturing, and of course, accidents isn't there. It remains active in our ecosystem for up to a quarter of a million years, much of it concentrating in our food and water. Fish in particular can be suspect, especially if it comes from areas known to be contaminated by radioactive materials, such as the tritium-contaminated water releases into the Pacific Ocean that are coming out of Fukushima in Japan. This becomes more concerning when you talk with someone who understands this issue in all of its many nasty manifestations, and she tells you.
What's happening now is there are some countries that are banning seafood from Fukushima and more food products from Japan. And so what the Japanese government is doing in partnership with the US government and the US military is allowing the food that would have been banned by other countries to instead be sold in commissaries and served in restaurants on military bases in Japan.
Well, when Kimberly Roberson of the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network raises warnings about the radioactive contamination levels allowed in the U.S., let alone fed intentionally to our military, she lets us know about an upcoming webinar that goes into these issues in depth so that you get a close and personal look at yet another of the problems we face from that awful, devastating, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevy. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Kimberly Roberson of Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network about an important upcoming webinar on radioactive contamination of U.S. food and water and what Congress can do about it. We will also hear clips from a recent discussion I had with students who are studying nuclear issues at Wilmington College in Ohio and the Peace Resource Center. What do youth want to know about nuclear? This class provides excellent grounding for them all. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, the Nuke Watch Report with John LaForge, and more honest nuclear information than anyone wants to hear about with the current heat wave. But then, there's no such thing as global warming, is there? All of this coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 9, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting here in the U.S., where the South Texas Project Nuclear Operating Company nuclear plants, two units, were hit by Hurricane Beryl. It is unclear what measures were taken at the facility to prepare for the severe weather. However, Edwin Lyman, Director of Nuclear Power Safety at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C., posted on X, formerly Twitter, that the facility likely had to make some preparations and said the two reactors will probably have to be shut down. No word if that happened. Allies of Donald J. Trump are proposing that the United States restart the testing of nuclear weapons in underground detonations should the former president be reelected in November. A number of nuclear experts reject such a resumption as unnecessary and say it would threaten to end a testing moratorium that the world's major atomic powers have honored for decades. In the latest issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, Robert C. O'Brien, a former national security advisor to Mr. Trump, wrote, We must test new nuclear weapons for reliability and safely in the real world for the first time since 1992. Doing so, he added, would help the U.S., quote, maintain technical and numerical superiority to the combined Chinese and Russian nuclear stockpiles. Because nothing stops war more than the threat of bigger and worse weapons of war. In a totally counterintuitive report, NBC News asks, too much solar? How California found itself with an unexpected energy challenge. That the state is, at times, generating more solar energy than it can handle. It's to the point where loads of clean energy are going to waste. There's a simple solution for that. Shut down Diablo Canyon and let solar take up all the slack, which is not that much at this point, that's left by nuclear. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Numbnuts of the Week.
Looking for a vacation idea? You can explore the perils and promise of human ingenuity at the birthplace of the atomic bomb. Yes, an Oppenheimer vacation awaits you at Hanford. The Hanford site in southeastern Washington state is where plutonium was produced for the atomic bomb that dropped on Nagasaki. And especially since the Oppenheimer movie last year, it's been a real destination hotspot. A nuclear wasteland that has become a tourist magnet. A visit here is a plunge into the history of World War II and the Cold War, but it is also a trip to something more alien and frightening. Hanford is where Americans, summoning their pluck and optimism, tampered with the building blocks of the universe to construct weapons that would vaporize cities, send generations of school children hiding under desks, and poison the land selected for the project. And in the process, kill more than 200,000 Japanese people with only two bombs. In visiting B Reactor, which is where the plutonium was generated, you'll see a facility described as standard 1940s mad scientist stuff, with a doomsday vibe and a nice coat of seafoam green paint. Cheerful signs illustrated with Ziggy-like cartoon characters remind workers to extinguish their cigarettes and leave when an evacuation horn sounds. Yes, let's put a fun and glossy vibe on the most contaminated site in North America and possibly in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, who wouldn't want a vacation there? And that's why, to those who are behind this fun-loving exploitation of atrocity, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Internationally, according to a leading U.S. analyst, the threat of the United States and South Korea agreeing to a NATO-style nuclear sharing arrangement could be used to pressure China to restrain North Korea from taking provocative actions. A major part of this strategy was the so-called temporary deployment of U.S. nuclear delivery systems to the South for exercises and the two allies' integration of conventional and nuclear capabilities. This would involve planning and exercises to combine conventional South Korean forces with U.S. nuclear operations. Given the United States' propensity for placing nuclear weapons in foreign countries and then leaving them there, the advisability of such an action is open to debate. In Israel, a senior Israeli lawmaker who has been labeled, quote, more unhinged by the minute, end quote, has suggested a nuclear attack on Iran. Former Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman took to the airwaves and social media to suggest his country should do whatever it takes to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, saying, right now there is no time to stop the Iranian nuclear program by using conventional means. Iran maintains its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. Although Kamal Karazi, a foreign policy advisor to Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, told the Financial Times earlier this week that his country would, quote, have to change our doctrine, end quote, if faced with an existential threat. Here, with an international perspective on nuclear issues and those who oppose nuclear, is the monthly NukeWatch report with NukeWatch co-founder and co-director John LaForge.
Much of the world frets about possible Russian or NATO nuclear attacks in the war in Ukraine. But instead of wringing their hands, Hopeful nuclear weapons resistors have been acting out against nuclear strike training going on in Germany, training for the unthinkable, which makes nuclear disaster more likely. Protesters have long been getting in the way of the nuclear strike planners at Germany's Buschel Air Force Base, and some are now paying a heavy price for their interference. Susan Crane from Redwood City, California, and Susan Vanderheiden from Amsterdam, both Catholic workers who aid the homeless, turned themselves in at Rohrbach Prison, 76 miles from Buchholz Base, on June 4th, following an upbeat four-day peace walk that started from the nuclear base. Crane is serving 7.5 months for trespass convictions following 6 go inactions at the NATO nuclear site, and Vanderheiden almost 4 months for similar protests. Buchholz Air Base has between 10 and 20 U.S. hydrogen bombs and is notorious because German pilots flying German jets rehearse plans to detonate the U.S. H-bombs against areas in Russia. I say areas rather than targets, because these U.S. H-bombs, known as B-61s, are between 3 and 11 times deadlier than the Hiroshima bomb, which burned 4.4 square miles and killed 140,000 people. The mass effects of our modern H-bombs cannot be limited to targets any more than, say, a hurricane can. With the U.S. H-bombs also stationed at bases in Italy, Belgium, Holland, and Turkey, and the Russian equivalent in Belarus, the risk of the Ukraine war going nuclear is treated as if it's not avoidable. But European and U.S. peace activists have for years demonstrated a way to reduce this threat. Call it rules-based de-escalation. Which rules? Well, the two Susans explain in a recent letter from prison, the U.S. bombs are, quote, not legal under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, under the Hague Conventions, the Geneva Conventions, and the Nuremberg Charter, all of which both Germany and the U.S. have ratified. The Non-Proliferation Treaty explicitly forbids any transfer whatsoever of nuclear weapons from one signatory to another. Susan Crane is the first U.S. woman to go to prison in Germany in the anti-nuclear campaign. Vanderheiden is the first Dutch woman to do so. And Crane's sentence is the longest ever imposed in the three-decade-long string of protests against Buschel. NATO's ready willingness to incinerate whole cities, a readiness that Buschel's war planners and pilots embody and practice, is such an openly criminal act, regardless of what Russia does, that resistors do more than physically interfere with the operations on base. They provide the court system with an opportunity to consider the legality of making bomb threats. Compared to symbolic demands to delegitimize and reject nuclear weapons as the only means of reducing the risk of nuclear attacks. The two wrote also, quote, the judges who sentenced us for these actions made a decision to follow some laws and ignore others. It is common sense, and we all know that even the law against trespass can be broken when life is endangered, end quote. After considering the immediate effects of even the smallest nuclear weapons detonations, like those at Hiroshima or Nagasaki, millions the world over have agreed with the two Susans that preparing nuclear massacres is a criminal conspiracy and is never justifiable. Nonviolent resistors like Crane and Vanderheiden and dozens of others have presented the courts with valid legal arguments for ousting the U.S. H-bombs. The judges now have been given a perfectly crafted opportunity to declare that Germany's importation of nuclear terrorism is unlawful and must be halted. Political jail going, now being practiced at Rohrbach Prison by the two Susans, has a long history of prompting political change. And, at least in the West, such conscientious protest has at least the possibility of moving the courts and even governments to demand some level-headed nuclear de-escalation. From the Nuke Watch office in Wisconsin, this has been John LaForge for Nuclear Hot Seat.
We'll have this week's feature in just a moment, but first, I sometimes don't realize the reach and impact that Nuclear Hot Seat has, but this week's report on my recent webinar for college students really brought that home. A few students referenced specific episodes that they had already listened to or were in the middle of. Instructor Tanya Maus framed her introduction of me through what she heard on Nuclear Hot Seat number 1, which is so dark ages I really don't even remember it. But apparently she heard me say that I wanted to do something to support the movement. Now, more than 13 years later, that's exactly what I have been doing with this show. And when some students shared that they had been having trouble finding information about their chosen topics, I was able to steer them towards appropriate interviews and support groups to contact. Which is all to say that Nuclear Hot Seat matters. It has a role to play, not just now, but well into the future. And it's a resource to be mined for rich veins of information on all aspects of the nuclear industry. Our archives are available for free to anyone who wants to avail themselves of the information. Just go to the website and poke around in the search bar. But in order for us to keep going and keep doing this work, we need your support. I invite you to help celebrate Nuclear Hot Seat's start of its 14th year by sending us a donation of any amount, or $14 if you want to keep it consistent. You can also set up a recurring donation for as little as $5 a month. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. So go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button and follow the prompts, or you can send to us directly through Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Whatever you can do to help, thanks so much for your support. I'm deeply grateful. And here we go. Onward. Now here is the first of this week's two features. It's always a joy to be able to speak with young people about nuclear issues, to open their minds, help them find information, and encourage them to remain connected to the issues in whatever way they can. So I was excited and honored when Tanya Maus, head of the Peace Resource Center at Wilmington College in Ohio, asked me to speak to her class entitled Hiroshima's Shadows. This course name was taken from the 1995 anthology of the same title by Kai Bird and Lawrence Lifschultz. Those of us who oppose nuclear and work against it often ask each other, how do we get younger activists involved in the battle against nukes? What does youth want to know? Well, here was the chance to find out, in person and on the hoof. What follows are just a few excerpts from the session I had with 10 students and their instructor. Each of the students had chosen a subject area and needed to come up with a research paper on it. I found them concerned, motivated, extremely intelligent, and totally engaged, and enjoyed the questions they put to me. I talked with 10 members of the class, plus Tanya Maus, via Zoom on Monday, July 8, 2024. To open the session, Tanya Maus explained a little bit about how she came to create this course and what was included in it.
I started this last fall after the Oppenheimer film came out, and I started thinking about what kinds of information was not included in the film. And so that's how I started developing the list of topics. Intentionally to think about nuclear harm, because I talked with this afternoon about how nuclear harm is not something that people in the United States think very much about, because we've really been taught that nuclear is a solution to military conflict and that it's a solution to energy crises. And so there's not often a chance for us to think about the harms of nuclear. And so this is just one class where they can pause and do that through their research paper topics. Maybe they come out of it thinking something different or in the future, but this is the space where they can take a moment and reflect on that.
Then we launched into a wide-ranging Q&A, which I tried my best to keep up with, even though I had no notes on what they were going to be asking.
I am studying the Navajo mines, and I was just really shocked at how the American people sent all these men into these mines, knowing that there was risks and complications with them being in the mines with their no ventilation, and they still sent them in there anyways. And didn't give them, like, any warnings, no compensation or anything.
That is indicative of the way the nuclear industry operates.
They don't care who gets harmed, how they get harmed, or what they get harmed by, as long as their executives keep making insane amounts of money, their shareholders get insane amounts of money. They don't care. And especially in terms of environmental racism, they don't care about Native Americans. It's just another level, you know. They don't have the forts and the soldiers and the rifles going after them anymore. They can just send them into the mines or have accidents or have contamination on the land and do nothing about it. And that way it becomes slow motion genocide, as opposed to something that we could point at and say, stop that right now. You know, the radiation, the radioactivity is invisible. And unless you're hit with a catastrophic dose of it, it takes years, decades, and longer for the impact to show up. Or it will show up through the generations. Maybe the parent will be okay, but a child will show some kind of problem that is DNA based and can be traced back to the radiation exposure. So if you're asking how they can do it, they think they are immune to the consequences of their actions. They're not going to be harmed. They're just going to get the goods. And all they want is for the work to be done. And as Leslie Groves, head of the Manhattan Project, said about the people who were living in proximity to the Trinity blast before that blast took place, this is a quote, "They are a low use segment of the population and we don't have to worry about them." That's going all the way back to 1945, and that sense has not changed in all those years.
I was just very shocked at, and reading everything, I was just very shocked at how they exploited these people. So thank you for elaborating.
My question was, like, after reading more about the nuclear stuff, and especially with Chernobyl, the main thing I found was the, speaking with Chernobyl mainly, the cover-up of it. Like, I've noticed, like, even reading the book Nagasaki by Susan Southern, they wanted to cover it up. Like, I'm more curious, like, if you even know anything about the cover-up, why do they want to cover it up so bad? Like, why can't we tell people about it and let them know, kind of thing?
Thank you for asking that question, because that gets the springboard into one of my most passionate topics, and that is the way the nuclear industry manipulates its image and the media. Basically, they have unlimited funds. We are talking about in the multiple millions of dollars to fund a PR propaganda campaign that casts them always in the good light, denigrates, undercuts, or sues anybody who speaks against them, and puts their talking points out in a concentrated way. They do focus groups to, those of you who are in advertising know about this, do focus groups to test their talking points, to find the ones that are going to work. What's the button that they can push? And then there is something called the World Nuclear Association, which is just, you know, big trade organization. But they have a branch called World Nuclear News. And you can subscribe to this. They send out one email a week with a minimum of 20 stories dealing with nuclear issues from their perspective at all. You know, never has heard a discouraging word. Or the majority of them are like 650 to 800 words. In other words, newspapers, which at this point don't have the money for reporters, let alone a dedicated reporter on this extremely complex topic, are always looking for stories that they don't have to pay for, that they can plug in, that makes them look like they're doing their job. So here's World Nuclear News, and they go, here are this week's 20 nuclear stories. Pick and choose whichever ones you want. You want to talk with somebody? We'll put you in touch with somebody. I don't know how many people they have on staff, because it's held completely private. I sense that there's a staff of at least 7 people who work on this, simply because of so much writing and research goes into it. But they're on full-time salary at a very high rate, and they pump this information out to surgically implant in people's minds the talking points they want to put forward. And I have watched from before the time that they were talking about nukes are green to the point where everybody goes, well, nukes are green and we need them to fight climate change. No, nukes are the deadliest enemy in the battle against climate change, because it siphons off the money that needs to go to genuine renewables, the attention that needs to go to genuine renewables. And it convinces people that nukes are the answer, so we should go in that direction. And there's no pushback against it, even in Congress, even in educational places other than classes like this one. what they are doing is brainwashing the world for more nukes. And why do they do that? Follow the money. By selling nuclear reactors, they are selling technology that they design, manufacture, build, operate, train people for, come up with the fuel rods and come up with all of the replacement parts. So they're in control of the physical plant. You want to shut one down? Well, the whole thing's radioactive and you've got all those spent fuel rods in the fuel pool. So they then need to have management done to take care of all that radioactive material. And because these fuel rods contain plutonium, which is radioactive for 250,000 years, a half-life of 25,000 years, it's infinite. So they create the problem, they sell the problem at a great high rate, they get paid to run the problem, and when the problem is over, the problem continues, so they are paid to continue. So it is a perpetual motion of employment and insane amounts of money. The reason that they want to keep this going, they want the money to keep going. Every nuclear reactor, when it was first licensed and put into operation, had to create a fund of money put aside for the eventual decommissioning and safe storage of the material. And they were only supposed to operate for 40 years because the engineers who built them said, after that, we're in danger of something called embrittlement. And it's just that. The metal that contains the nuclear reactor becomes brittle by the bombardment of all the neutrons flying around. And that weakens it and that makes it more prone to having an accident. So 40 years was all it was supposed to happen. And then it was supposed to be decommissioned. Well, they've extended to 60. They're extending to 80 years now, which is crazy. But in all that time, money has been put aside and gaining interest. So these funds have got hundreds of millions of dollars, if not in certain instances, over $1 billion in them. The nuclear industry looks at that and doesn't go, oh, look at what a good job we can do and how long we can do it. They go, how fast and how cheap can we make this decommissioning appear so we can grab the rest of this money as our profit? And that has been the case over and over again. Two words you never want to hear in connection with anything nuclear is fast and cheap, because that's when mistakes get made. And those are mistakes that, unfortunately, because of the nature of radioactivity, we and our descendants, should we have any, and their descendants, should they have any, will be living with forever.
Yeah, emphasize that point that I think the estimate for cleaning up the Hanford site is at about $640 billion. I mean, it's unbelievable amounts of money that we cannot even, you know, conceive of in our ordinary lives for the nuclear cleanup and the money that's in this industry.
Given that Wilmington College and the Peace Resource Center are located in Ohio, it was no surprise that there was interest expressed in the Ohio nuclear bailout scandal, which showed the former Speaker of the House of Ohio, Larry Householder, being sent to prison for 20 years.
Since my topic is the Ohio nuclear bailout and the amount of dollars, I just listened to, or I'm halfway through the nuclear bailout episode of your podcast. So I saw that on there today and I was like, I need to listen to that. So just the sheer amount of dollars, it's like more than we can even imagine, the type of money that they throw at these things. And in our area specifically right now, it seems to be the biggest fight, at least in my county and surrounding counties. Nobody wants solar because it's expensive and it's ugly and it'll contaminate, you know, all these farmland and fields. And then learning more about, you know, solar and whatever it would contaminate compared to a nuclear meltdown, I feel like this is a fight, you know, cut your nose off to spite your face. You're paying billions of dollars to have 50, 60, 70 year old nuclear plants bailed out. But solar is too ugly, too expensive, and all these panels are going to, you know, make this farmland completely unusable. It just blows my mind that they don't turn around and think, what does nuclear power do to not just farmlands, but anybody that lives around it? I've never heard of solar panels contaminating and radiating somebody's body, but that seems to be the biggest argument in our area. And I just can't wrap my mind around it.
You know, I wonder why the solar industry doesn't mount a comparable PR campaign to counter what nuclear is doing and put out their talking points. I've written periodically to various companies, but I haven't done anything in a concerted way.
The dollar amounts of money that they spend compared to, and I know we've had solar companies that have come into our area and they have money too, but it's nowhere near, it's not even close to what nuclear has. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know if it's a battle of the dollars or, like you said, the just constantly in your face publication, but.
They are maniacal about getting their talking points out. Anytime they know that something is coming up, an anniversary, I can tell you already that they are writing their editorials and op-ed pieces for 2025 because that's the 80th year since this mess started, since Trinity, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki. And with the year ending in zero, if a year ends in a zero or a five, but especially a zero, the media goes nuts. In between, it's like, it's been 43 years since, nobody cares. 50 years, hoo-ha, then they get excited. And this is for anything that's got an anniversary coming up. But I can tell you, they're already working on their talking points and they're thinking it out from any different angle. So they're prepared. They just roll this stuff out because they've got the money, they've got the manpower. They might have woman power in there too, I don't know. But they have no conscience. They have no empathy. They have no humanity, as far as I'm concerned. Because once they understand what they are doing, they turn away from it if they have any humanity in them at all. And what you were saying about people living around nuclear reactors, every nuclear reactor, this has been proven, leaks radioactive tritium-contaminated water into the groundwater. And the nuclear industry says, you know, it's a weak sister. It's not very much, but it is. It's radioactive. It's dangerous. It accumulates in the body. There's no way to get rid of it once it is in there. And so every nuclear reactor, the studies that have been done around it show increases in child leukemia rates, increases in child thyroid cancer rates. And these are not government subsidized. These have to come from private funds, private institutions, or we do get some good work out of Ian Fairley, who is in the UK. His reports are excellent. I always love it when I get him on the show.
So as I'm studying up on my topic for the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant, I have read that a lot of the protest and controversy that had gone on with this plant is based on its proximity to a lot of fault lines. And that caused a lot of controversy, rightfully so. So as we've discussed, nuclear is already a very dangerous and almost fragile thing, I guess, to try to maintain or kind of keep in the balance. So I was just wondering why there wasn't more government pushback or maybe like zoning pushback saying, hey, you can't build this here. This is, you know, already going to make a dangerous thing a lot more dangerous to a lot of people. I just wondered why that wasn't kind of more discussed before they, you know, kind of took over and started building the plant.
That's a great question. First of all, you've got to think back as to when this was. I think they started building it, what, in the early 1960s, something like that. So we were not hip to the kind of problems that could happen. This was like the going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. It was going to be energy that, quote unquote, this is a genuine quote, too cheap to meter, as opposed to ending up being the most expensive way to generate electricity on Earth. Also the most expensive way to boil water, but that's another subject. There were earthquake faults in proximity and actually directly underneath the Diablo Canyon nuclear facility that were not found, had not been discovered at the time that it was figured out that they were going to build there and it built. All they were concerned about was the access to the water because enormous, crazy amounts of water are needed to cool that on a daily basis. And it raises the temperature and the environment and the ecology of the ocean around it. What you need to understand about Diablo Canyon is how meticulously the other side has manipulated the image. First of all, if you want sources on this, you must be talking with and in contact with San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. They're the cornerstone group there. I've interviewed them many, many times on the show. You can just go back and hear the progression of what's been going on there. When the plant, the last reactor was supposed to be shut down, and they were both supposed to be shut down, and that was in the process, the nuclear industry, PG&E, I think it was, Pacific Gas and Electric, were ballistic because they were going to be losing their cash cow. So they had some kind of a meeting, and one of their guys stood up in front and said, we really need a pushback. Is there anybody here who wants to start a group called Mothers for Nuclear? And this was a meeting with employees of Diablo Canyon, who, of course, wanted to keep their job. And two extremely telegenic women, well-spoken women, stood up and said, yes, we would like to. They were taken in. And we had people in the audience that night who watched this whole thing happen, some of the Mothers for Peace. I think Linda Seeley can give you that story. They were brought in. They were schooled. They were coached. They were given talking points. They were given money. All of the lobbying efforts, quote unquote, citizen lobbying efforts to keep Diablo Canyon open, completely paid for by the nuclear industry, completely tricked out. And it's been that way. Plus, Gavin Newsom, you should pardon the expression, thinks he's going to be running for president at some point. And I can tell you, he's already building his war chest, or at least he's putting his allies in place, the people who can come up with the hundreds of millions of dollars in a single check to fund his campaign. So there's a lot of politics involved, a lot. We had this thing set to shut down. It was already on the schedule. I said, oh no, we're going to pull this back from the brink. And for the details on that, I've done a lot of stories on it. I would just say, go back, listen to the interviews. I've got Kevin Camps. I've got the Mothers for Peace. I've got Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education. I've got some really big people talking about exactly what this is. And Harvey Wasserman. He's someone who has a weekly show, Solartopia. It's on KPCC or KPFK out here in Los Angeles, and you can get it on the internet. But he's really hot on Diablo Canyon and covers it regularly. So the information is there. But basically, talk with the Mothers for Peace to get that information and listen to the interviews on Nuclear Hot Seat. It will give you a much better sense of where we stand now. And it's a moving target. It keeps changing. So sign up for the email for Mothers for Peace as well. By the way, any of these groups that are being mentioned will have email, including Nuclear Hot Seat, have email that goes out every week, every month, whatever. You need to be on it if you're interested in the topic, because that's going to be one of your best sources for the latest of what's happening.
Throughout all of the atomic bombs and all of the impacts that have impacted the people, my question is kind of just about how have they moved on emotionally and like socially and like their mental health throughout that, because they don't really talk a lot about that throughout my research. And my research is on Marshall Island, and there's a lot of stuff going back and forth about the people not getting what they really needed for support.
Okay, Marshall Islands, there is a movie called Atomic Savages that is available online. It was actually created for Frontline, for PBS. And I don't know what happened, where, or how, but they ended up turning it down. So it's been independently distributed. It was the one that opened my eyes to what's happening in the Marshall Islands. I was just last December in New York at the United Nations for meetings on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Tanya, is that something that you've covered in your course at all?
We talk about that toward the end of the course, so we haven't covered it yet.
It was the second meeting of states parties, meaning the countries that have signed on to this, which is an international treaty to ban nuclear weapons. It is international law, though only the countries without nuclear weapons so far are obeying it. And while I was there, I was privileged to be allowed into a session on communities that are downwind communities, and specifically the international ones that aren't usually covered. And that included many people from the Marshall Islands, from French Polynesia and the like. And one of the points they made is that they don't like to talk about it to outsiders, because every time they do, it re-traumatizes them. They have to, on some level, relive it. And even if they didn't go through it, their parents did. Their grandparents did. They have seen the impact in terms of cancers, in terms of birth defects, in terms of fetal death. And all of this is extremely difficult. So when you ask someone from the Marshall Islands or French Polynesia or any of the places where nuclear bombs were tested, Australia and the like, when you ask them, you're asking them to relive something that is not pleasant. And we do so cavalierly because we want the information. I mean, I've done that too, but my awareness was raised by this workshop, and it has made me much more cautious in my approach and in my asking. There is a community of Marshall Islanders in, I think it's Arkansas, and they have a center there. The young man who is the head of it recently won the Nuclear Free Future Award, which is major. I've won it. A woman from French Polynesia also won it, but he was one of the winners. You can look him up under Nuclear Free Future Award, or you can do a Google search for Marshall Islands. That would be a good place to go because they would have information that is curated and generally available to you. They have not gotten anything except to be studied like guinea pigs. They were lied to. Their lands were made totally unlivable. They will never be able to reclaim their lands. They have totally lost their ancestral way of life and all the knowledge that came with it. They have been decimated as a people, and they have been ignored by the United States government. They were not given medical care. They were studied like lab rats. We basically, as a nation, behaved like Joseph Mengele did during World War II for the Nazis. He's the one who did experiments on people in the concentration camps, usually cutting them open without anesthetic, doing horrible things to them. Mengele is synonymous with atrocious, horrific abuse through medical means. And we behaved like Mengele. So there's no justification for what the United States did or continues to do in ignoring them or foofing them away. And they deserve so much more than they have received from us. And I don't know if they'll ever get it, but certainly they have good people fighting for it now. And those are the ones you deserve to be in touch with because they will give you the real story.
Yeah. So for people who, you know, we're going to spend some time on the Marshall Islands in the next couple of weeks. And so those of you who maybe don't have the context is that the United States was testing extremely large nuclear weapons from 1946 in the Marshall Islands. And purposely irradiating Marshallese who were indigenous to those islands and studying the impact of radiation on that population over time. And so it's a very well-documented atrocity in regard to the Marshallese. There are Marshallese who have now migrated to the United States. There's actually a population in Lima, which is about an hour north of here. And we have had people from the Marshallese community participate in PRC events in the past where they've traveled down from Lima and their children have traveled down from Lima to talk about their experiences. So yeah, we will learn more about it.
So I know you touched just a little bit on it earlier about censorship, and I know we're reading about it heavily in the book by Susan Southard right now, but I wanted to know if you have run into any type of censorship issues within your interviews or just like as you've gone through the years of your interviews?
I have only once intentionally interviewed somebody on the other side. I am transparent about my bias. This is a program against nuclear, but I do not call it an anti-nuclear program because people tend to bounce off anything that says that they discount it. So I just say it's nuclear news from a different perspective. What's the different perspective? Well, why don't you listen and find out? So in terms of my work being censored, no. I have no boss. I've got a board of directors. I am a nonprofit, but they're all on my side. So basically, I can do whatever I want to with this as long as I don't break FCC regulations and I get permission from the people I interview to interview them, as we asked for permission from all of you to be able to use anything that you happen to say that might be appropriate here. So no, the important thing to know about the censorship in Japan, I don't know if she covers this or not, but immediately upon signing the surrender, Japan signing the surrender on the USS Missouri, Douglas MacArthur, General MacArthur, was in charge of the entire occupation. He immediately put down an edict that no Japanese medical person and no Japanese media person could write or say or record anything about the impact of the atomic bombs on the people of Japan. That was law. And actually, the first time that was contravened was kind of in code. I don't know if you've watched the original Japanese version of Godzilla. Godzilla was an anti-nuclear film, but they couldn't state that. Godzilla itself is a metaphor for the bomb. Godzilla does not release radiation. It has atomic breath or something like that. But the real news was that at the beginning of the film, there's a long segment where all you see is these sailors on a fishing boat being rocked by the waters. And I forget if there's an attack where you actually see Godzilla or not. But by the time they got into port, they're all sick and they're all dying. That was a direct reference to the Lucky Dragon, which was the ship that was in the explosion pattern of
Castle Bravo.
Yeah, Castle Bravo. Thank you. Which was one of the Marshall Islands explosions. And by the time they got into port, they were all sick with radiation poisoning. I forget how many of them died, but this was the first time that fallout was allowed to be mentioned in the news. And people in Japan would have known it. So that starting 5, 6, 7 minutes of Godzilla showing what happened to the sailors on that ship, that was a direct reference to fallout and radiation, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. And people in Japan would have known that, though people in the United States would not, because we knew nothing about what had happened to people on the ground, because that was evaporated, with one exception, which is the core piece of my play. Those were questions from members of the class Hiroshima's Shadows, taught by Tanya Mouse, who is head of the Peace Resource Center at Wilmington College in Ohio. The book they are studying from is Susan Southard's Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. We will link to that book as well as the Peace Resource Center on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 681.
Activist shout out.
An important webinar is coming up next week that will be on radioactive contamination of U.S. food and water and what Congress can do about it. This congressional briefing is being produced by Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network and a coalition of groups, including Beyond Nuclear, three chapters of Physicians for Social Responsibility, Ecological Options Network, San Clemente Green, and Food and Water Watch. I spoke with Kimberly Roberson, the lead organizer of this webinar and the founder and head of Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, to learn more. I'm talking with Kimberly Roberson, who is project director for the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network. Kimberly, what is this congressional briefing about?
It's to educate Congress about Fukushima's ongoing impact on our food supply and our health. It's been 11 years since the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, or FAN, filed a citizen petition with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to lower the current allowable levels of man-made radiation in our food supply. And we feel that 11 years is long enough.
Why should we be concerned about Fukushima's impact on our food supply?
We need to get a serious process going because of recent policies that are doubling down on nuclear. It's clear that we're going to be dealing with more waste, and FDA needs to get serious about this issue. We plan to put more of a focus on our asks for serious monitoring, testing, and relaying transparent information to the public.
One of the quotes from your press materials that I really related to was where it was written, "Food from Japan that exceeds Japan's radioactivity standards and cannot be sold there is nonetheless sold and served to U.S. consumers here and to U.S. servicemen and women overseas." How has that been allowed to happen?
Well, it seems to be part of a larger promotional campaign to share food or share the pain. Actually, we've seen Japan's policy of sharing the pain going way back to 2011. With the mass incineration of the debris from Fukushima Daiichi. And this is an issue that is impacting the entire world. What's happening now is there are some countries that are banning seafood from Fukushima and more food products from Japan. And so what the Japanese government is doing in partnership with the U.S. government and the U.S. military is allowing the food that would have been banned by other countries to instead be sold in commissaries and served in restaurants on military bases in Japan. So that is overseas.
Give us an idea of what the levels are. what's allowed in Japan and why can food in excess of those levels be sold in the United States? What's our limit?
Our limit is 1,200 becquerel per kilogram across the board, adults and children. In Japan, it's 100 becquerel per kilogram, and this is cesium, by the way, for adults, and 50 for much younger children and for baby food, 50 becquerel per kilogram.
So that makes it 12 times more radioactivity in the food from Japan that is sent to the United States than they will allow their own citizens to eat.
That's correct. And while it may not be a 1,200 becquerel in the United States coming over from Japan, they are legally allowed to export that. We don't know exactly what it is. That's why we need the testing. And we need a lot more information to be available to the public than what we're getting now.
So this webinar with Congress, which is going under the title Radioactive Contamination of U.S. Food and Water and What Congress Can Do About It, who is going to be presenting information at this briefing and what kind of information will they be presenting?
We have a wonderful team for this event. Dr. Arjun Makajani, who wrote the book Exploring Tritium Dangers, will be presenting. His book calls for policy in an area that has been historically overlooked, tritium. And then we also have Dr. Bob Richman, who is a professor of marine biology laboratory sciences at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. He'll be talking about bioaccumulation, biomagnification in the food chain from a marine perspective. Then we also have James Gormley. He is the Citizens for Health Senior Policy Advisor, and Citizens for Health is one of our coalition members who filed the petition with FDA. And Cindy Folkers with Beyond Nuclear will be our moderator. And I will also be presenting. I have worked in the field of nutrition and have founded Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network. I spearheaded the coalition to get the FDA citizen petition together. All of the coalition helped. But I think it kind of goes back to the first petition I wrote on March 31st of 2011. It was a change.org petition. It led to my book, Silence Deafening, Fukushima Fallout, A Mother's Response. And that led to blogging and other things and to this other petition with FDA. And by the way, I want to mention, I think a lot of your listeners know, we have the FDA citizen petition for comment. And then we also have the moveon.org petition, which we call the companion petition to FDA, and that one is for signature. And both are up on our website.
Both will be up on the Nuclear Hot Seat website under this episode, number 681. What do you hope will be the immediate response to the fact that you are having this webinar, this press conference happening?
Well, I think it may surprise a lot of people to know that we don't have better food regulations in place. We are consistently reassured whenever it does come up by the Food and Drug Administration that the levels of man-made radiation in our food are well within their guidelines. But what they don't mention is that they have some of the weakest guidelines in the world.
And this is obviously a step to force at least discussion, if not an actual change to those standards.
Absolutely. I think before it was kind of status quo. But the FDA has not really updated their protection action guide in many years, since 1996. And before that, it was 1982. And then we also have the International Commission for Radiological Protections, otherwise known as the ICRP. They issue the guidance that most countries follow. And we'll go into this more in the briefing, but it's a pretty broad guideline. It's very surprising what some of those documents say in the ICRP 111. We'll be talking about that. So you've got ICRP, which issues guidance. You've got FDA that has their own guidance. We need to get clarity on what it all means. And by bringing this before Congress, we're hoping that lawmakers will take action and that their constituents will continue to ask for the action. That's why these petitions are so important. It's a direct connection to what's going on, and it's a way for us to raise our voices and be heard. By the way, nothing has really changed with FDA that I know of since Japan started dumping the radioactive wastewater at Fukushima last August, I believe it was, the very beginning of last August, 1.5 million tons that is partially filtered because tritium is not being filtered at all, or carbon-14. And then we don't even know how safely filtered the other radionuclides are, strontium, for example, as you well know.
All of these points about radiation will be gone into during the briefing, will they not?
Yes, they will.
So if people are interested in at least watching this webinar, this briefing, when and where will this briefing be held? And how can those who are interested attend?
It will be held via Zoom webinar. Gone are the days where you had to get a room with a, you know, some kind of equipment or cater the lunch. You don't have to do that anymore. Now that COVID happened, they decided to take the webinar route. So that's what we're going to do via Zoom. There will be a registration link up on our website and also, I think, on the Nuclear Hot Seat website.
Of course.
And it's just really easy. You just go on and register like you would for a Zoom meeting.
Kimberly, I want to thank you and the others for putting together such meaningful programs. Hopefully, there will be members of Congress, or at least their staffs, that will take this seriously and be in attendance. And we'll check back with you in the coming weeks to find out how things are going.
That sounds good, Libby. Thank you so much.
Kimberly Roberson, founder of the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network. We will have a link up to where you can register for this timely and important webinar on radioactive contamination of U.S. food and water and what Congress can do about it. It's being held next Monday, July 15, at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And on the website, you can find a link to where you can sign up for it. NuclearHotSeat.com, episode 681. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 9th, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it simple to do. Go to NuclearHotSeat.com, look for the yellow opt-in box, you really can't miss it, fill it in with your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one, only one, email from us, which has a link to that week's show and a brief description of some of the material that's in it. You can also sign up on your favorite podcast channel if you listen to podcasts a lot, but by doing it through the website, we get points on Google's search algorithm, and it makes it easier for people to find Nuclear Hot Seat. Now, you can help us out because we're always looking for the next nuclear story. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And please remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your support. Anything helps, and we're extremely grateful for whatever you can do. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Nuclear Hot Seat and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, and the name of any people whose comments you use. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you we can always come up with the date that a nuclear incident or accident starts. But we can't come up with a date when it's over because once it starts, unfortunately, it is never over. There you have it. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.